Geekscape.com.
White supremacy and Negro subordination. Part 3. Chapter 3. The Human Creation. The human creation, like all other families or forms of being, is composed of a genus, which includes some half dozen or more species. It has been the fashion to call these permanent varieties, and almost every writer on ethnology has made his own classification, or rather has created what number he pleased of these imaginary varieties. Agassiz, unquestionably the greatest of American naturalists, but unfortunately not much of a physiologist, and therefore unprepared to deal with the higher truths of ethnology, supposes several species of white men, and in regard to the subordinate races, would doubtless multiply them ad infinitum. But at this time, or in the existing state of our knowledge, the number actually known to exist cannot be assumed beyond that already named. They are thus: first, the Caucasian; second, the Mongolian; third, the Malay or Oceanic; fourth, the Aboriginal American; fifth, the Eskimo; and sixth, the Negro or typical African. The Caucasian can be confounded with no other, for though in some localities climate and perhaps other causes darken the skin, sometimes with a deep olive tint, and extending, as with the Bedouins and the Jews of the Malabar coast, to almost black, the flowing beard, more constant than colour, projecting forehead, oval features, erect posture, and lordly presence stamp him the master man wherever found. The Mongolian, though less distinctive, is, however, sufficiently so, for his yellow skin, squat figure, beardless face, pyramidal head, and almond eyes can scarcely be confounded with any other form of man. The Malay is less known, and therefore more difficult to describe. They are darker than the Mongol, though in some islands of a bright copper colour, and indeed vary from light olive to dark brown, and as in the case of the Australians, to deep black, but with no other approximation to the Negro. The vast populations known under the term Papuan, and mainly Malay, are doubtless extensively mixed with the Negro. For however remote the time, or whatever the form or mode, real Negro populations have resided in tropical Asia and left behind them these remains of their former existence. In some islands, like New Zealand, the ruling dynasties or principal families have a considerable infusion of Caucasian blood, which is shown in their tall, erect form, more or less beard, fair complexion, and manly presence, and intellectually in their prompt and often intelligent acceptance of Christianity. The Indian, American, or Aboriginal needs no description. Suffice it to say that from the mouth of the Columbia River to Cape Horn, they are the same species. It is quite possible, indeed probable, that some species formerly existing on this continent have disappeared, utterly perished. The investigations of Dr. Tashudi warrant this belief, though his nice discriminations in regard to some of the bones of the head are of little or no importance, as all this might be, and doubtless was, the result of artificial causes. But crania discovered in southern Mexico and Yucatan, as well as in Peru and Brazil, are sufficient evidence to warrant the belief that a still inferior race did once really inhabit this continent, but, whether aboriginal or brought here by some superior race, may never be known. The remains of ancient structures in Yucatan, in Peru, in Mexico, in Brazil, all over the southern portion of the continent, show simply the traces of Caucasian intrusion. It has been generally supposed that Columbus and his companions were the first white men that ever visited this continent, but it may have been discovered, and to a certain extent occupied, at least certain localities occupied, before even Europe itself, or before the period of authentic history. Anyone visiting Mexico, Puebla, or other cities of Spanish America is amazed and bewildered with the contrast between the vast and magnificent structures that meet his eye and the existing population. He involuntarily asks himself, can these people be the authors of all this art, this beauty, this strength and magnificence? Can these miserable, barefooted, blanketed, idle and stolid-looking creatures have built these palaces, these churches, these bridges, these mighty structures, which seem to have been built for eternity itself? So strong and secure are their foundations. Some years hence, this contrast would be still more palpable, and left to themselves, a time would come when it would be obvious that the existing population had nothing to do with these structures, for the mixed blood would have disappeared, and there would be only the simple, unadulterated Native American, as discovered by the Spaniards 3 centuries ago. And we have only to apply this to the antiquities of America to understand its history, at all events, to understand the meaning of those half-buried monuments so frequently found on its surface. Adventurers, often, doubtless, shipwrecked mariners, were cast upon the coasts of America, possibly in some cases before Rome was founded, or Babylon itself was the mighty capital of a still more mighty empire. These enterprising or unfortunate men found themselves undisputed sovereigns of the New World. We know that Northmen found their way here in the 8th century, and doubtless they were preceded at intervals by numerous other Caucasians. Settling in some localities, they reigned undisputed masters, built cities, organized governments, framed laws, and laid the foundations of a civilized society. But, intermarrying with the natives, they were swallowed up by mongrelism, and in obedience to an immutable law of physical life, doomed to perish, and at a given period, the white blood extinct. There remained nothing to denote its former existence, except the half-buried palaces and ruined monuments yet to be traced over large portions of this continent. The Toltecs, Aztecs, etc. are simply the remnants of these extinct Caucasians, just as the present population, if left alone in Mexico, the latest portion of it, with Caucasian blood, would be the ruling force, and perhaps retain somewhat, or some portion, of the Spanish habitudes. The pure native mind is capable of a certain development, but that is fixed and determinate, and beyond which it can no more progress than it can alter the colour of its skin or the form of its brain. Powhatan's empire in Virginia was undoubtedly aboriginal and probably called out the utmost resources and reached the utmost limit of the Indian mind. The Indian has, and does manifest to a certain extent, a capacity of mental action, but this is too feeble and limited to make a permanent impression on the physical agents that surround him. And therefore he can have no history, for there are no materials, nothing to record. The term, therefore, Indian Antiquities, is a misnomer, and the great congressional enterprise under the editorship of Mr. Schoolcraft is an obvious absurdity. The Polar, or Eskimo race, has been least known of all, and prior to the explorations of that true hero and true son of science, the late Dr. Kane, was scarcely known except in name. It is both Asiatic and American, but which continent is its birthplace is a matter of doubt. The facilities for passing from one continent to the other were doubtless much greater, at some former period than at present, and not only men, but animals may have done so with ease. Except a few well-known species of animals and vegetables, which are essential to the well-being of the Caucasian, and which have accompanied him in all his migrations, each species has its own centre of existence, beyond or outside of which it is limited to a determinate existence. The Arctic animals are quite numerous and differ widely from all others, but they are absolutely the same in Asia as in America, and therefore must have passed from one to the other. And man, however subordinate or inferior to other races endowed by nature with ample powers of locomotion and migration, could meet with only trifling obstacles in passing from one continent to the other. This race, though, thus far of little or no importance, is doubtless superior to the Negro. For the necessities of its existence, the terrible struggle for very life in those bleak and desolate regions, infer the possession of powers superior to those of a race whose centre of life is in the fertile and luxuriant tropics, where nature produces spontaneously, and where the idle and sensual Negro only needs to gather these products to exist and multiply his kind. Finally, we have the Negro last, and least, the lowest in the scale, but possibly the first in the order of creation, for there are many reasons in the nature and structure of things that indicate, if they do not altogether warrant, the inference that the Negro was the first, and the Caucasian latest in the program of order of creation. The typical woolly-haired Negro may have been created in tropical Asia and carried thence to Africa, as in modern times he has been carried to tropical America. Like other subordinate races, it never migrates, but the extensive traces of its former existence in Asia show beyond doubt that this was either its primal home or that it had been carried there by the Caucasian, long anterior to the historic era. But it is now found in its pure state or specific form in Africa alone, and even here, large portions of it have undergone extensive adulteration. Our knowledge of Africa is very limited and consequently very imperfect. African travellers, explorers, missionaries, etc., ignorant of the ethnology, of the physiology, of the true nature of the Negro, and, moreover, bitten by modern philanthropy, a disease more loathsome and fatal to the moral than smallpox or plague to the physical nature, have been bewildered and perverted and rendered unfit for truthful observation or useful discovery before they set foot on its soil or felt a single flush of its burning sun. With the monstrous conception that the Negro was a being like themselves, with the same instincts and wants, and the same intent, the same mental capacities, all they saw, felt, or reasoned upon in Africa was seen through this false medium, and therefore is of little or no value. Thus, Barth and Livingstone, encountering a mongrel tribe or community, with of course a certain degree or extent of civilization, the result of Caucasian innovation, or perhaps the remains of a former pure white population, note it down and spread it before the world as evidence of Negro capacity and an indication of the future progress of the race. Myriads and countless myriads of white men have lived and died on the soil of Africa. Vast populations and entire nations have emigrated to that continent. At one time, there were 500,000 white Christians and 40,000 inmates of religious houses in the Valley of the Nile alone, while 300 Christian bishops assembled at Carthage, and it will be a reasonable assumption to say that since the Christian era, there have been 500 million whites in Africa. What has become of them? They have not emigrated, have not been slaughtered in battle, nor destroyed by pestilence, nor devoured by famine. And yet, these countless hosts, these innumerable millions, these Christian devotees and holy bishops, have all disappeared, as utterly perished, as if the earth had opened and swallowed them up. With the downfall of the Roman Empire, civilization receded from Africa, and the white population were gradually swallowed up by mongrelism. The Negro, being the predominant element, absorbed, or rather annihilated, the lesser one, and the result is now seen in numerous, almost countless, mixed hybrid or mongrel tribes and populations spread all over the continent. It is certainly possible, indeed probable, that there are two or three or more species of men, closely approximating, it is true, nevertheless specifically different from the woolly-haired or typical Negro. One of these, the Hottentots, with the true Negro features but of dirty yellow colour, it would seem almost certain must be a separate species, but until someone better qualified to judge than those hitherto relied on has investigated this subject, it is only safe to assume but a single species, and that the other and numerous populations of Africa, however resembling or approximating to the typical Negro, are hybrids and mongrels, the effect and expiring remains of the mighty populations and imposing civilizations that once flourished upon its soil. There may be also other species, besides the Mongol in Asia and besides the Malay in Oceanica, and it is quite probable that some species have totally perished. But it is certain that those thus briefly discussed now exist, that their location, their history, as far as they can be said to have a history, their physical qualities and mental condition, in short, their specific characters, are plainly marked and well understood. Nevertheless, and though all this belongs to the domain of fact, and it is as absurd to question it as it would be to question the existence of diverse species in any of the genera or families of the animal creation, the world generally holds to the notion of a single human race. It is not designed to expressly argue this point, for, to the American mind, it is so obvious, if not self-evident, that the human creation is composed of diverse species, that argument is misplaced, if not absolutely absurd. The European people rarely see the Negro or other species of men, and therefore the notion of a single human race or species with them is natural enough, indeed a mental necessity. Ethnologists, men of vast erudition, of noble intellect, and honest and conscientious intentions, have devoted their powers to this subject, and volume upon volume has been published to demonstrate the assumption of a single race. Buffon, Blumenbach, Tiedemann, Prichard, even Cuvier himself, have given in their adherence to this dogma, or rather, it should be said, have set out with the assumption of a single race, and collected a vast amount of material, of fact, or presumed fact, to demonstrate its supposed truth. Nor is it an easy matter to explode their sophistries or to disprove their assumptions. With great and admitted claims to scientific acquirement and powers of reasoning, they combine undoubted honesty of intention and seemingly careful and patient investigation, and the amount or extent of evidence adduced, the elaborate and mighty array of fact, of learned and imposing authority appealed to, and the fatiguing, if not unwarrantable, argument put forward, made it, and still make it difficult to reply to them, or to disprove their assumptions. Any question, no matter what its nature, or however deficient in the elements of truth, still admits of argument, and falsehood may often lead astray the reason, even when the judgment itself is convinced to the contrary. And these European advocates of the dogma of a single race have such a boundless field for discussion, can so bewilder and fatigue the reason, as well as pervert the imagination by their plausible arguments drawn from the analysis of animal life, that it is not wonderful they should lead astray the popular mind, nor is it surprising that those among us claiming to be men of science should bow to their authority. For though common sense rejects their arguments, there are few of sufficient mental independence to withstand that authority when backed up by such an imposing array of distinguished names. But the strong common sense that distinguishes our people will not be, indeed cannot be, deceived on this subject. The American or the Southern knows that the Negro is a Negro and is not a Caucasian, just as clearly, absolutely, and unmistakably as he knows that black is black and is not white, that a man is a man and is not a woman, that a pigeon is a pigeon and is not a robin, or a shad and not a salmon. He sees Negro parents have Negro offspring, that Indians have Indian offspring, and that whites have white offspring. Each after its kind, with the same regularity, uniformity, and perfect certainty that is witnessed in all other forms of existence. There is not a white man or woman in the Union who, if told of such a thing as white parents with Negro offspring or Negroes with white offspring, would believe it, even if sworn to by a million of witnesses. Such a belief or such a conception would be as monstrous and indeed impossible as to suppose that robins had begotten pigeons or horses asses. And the constant witnessing of this, this undeviating and perpetual order in the economy of animal life, demonstrates the specific character of the Negro beyond doubt or possible mistake. Irishmen, Germans, Frenchmen come here, settle down, become citizens, and their offspring born and raised on American soil differ in no appreciable or perceptible manner from other Americans. But Negroes may have been brought here 3 centuries ago, and their offspring of today is exactly as it was then, as absolutely and specifically unlike the American as when the race first touched the soil and first breathed the air of the New World. It is not intended, as already observed, to argue this matter. For it is a palpable and unavoidable fact that Negroes are a separate species, and though in succeeding chapters of this work the specific qualities are examined in detail, these detailed demonstrations are merely designed to present the physical differences in order to determine the moral relations, and not, by any means, to demonstrate a fact always palpable to the senses. Even those foolish people disposed to pervert terms or play upon words to admit the fact thus palpable, but ready to confound and to distort the reason by the application or use of false terms, cannot avoid the inevitable conclusion of distinct species. To conceal or keep out of sight this truth, some have thus admitted these everyday seen and unmistakable specific differences in dividing races, but a silly as strange perversity has prompted them to use the term permanent varieties instead of species, as if white and black were variations and not specialities. It is a fact, an existing, unalterable, demonstrable, and unmistakable fact that the Negro is specifically different from ourselves. A fact uniform and invariable, which has accompanied each generation, and under every condition of circumstances, of climate, social condition, education, time, and accident, from the landing at Jamestown to the present day. The naturalist, reasoning alone on this basis of fact, says that which has been uniform and undeviating for 300 years, in all kinds of climate and under all kinds of circumstance, in a state of freedom or condition of slavery, under the burning equator and amidst the snows of Canada, without change or symptom of change, must have been thus 3,000 years ago. And he reasons truly, for the excavations of Champollion and others demonstrate the specific character of this race 4,000 years ago, with as absolute and unmistakable certainty as it is now actually demonstrated to the external sense of the present generation. And the naturalist, reasoning still further on this basis of fact, says, that which has existed 4,000 years, without the slightest change or modification, which in all kinds of climate and under every condition of circumstances preserves its integrity and transmits, in the regular and normal order, to each succeeding generation, the exact and complete type of itself, must have been thus at the beginning, and when the existing order was first called into being by the Almighty Creator. And contemplating the subject from this standpoint, and reasoning from analogy, or exactly as we do in respect to other, and all other, forms of existence, the conclusion is irresistible and unavoidable that the several human races, or species, originally came into being exactly as they now exist, as we know they have existed through all human experience and without a recreation, must continue to exist so long as the world itself lasts or the existing order remains. But a large portion of the world believe that the Bible teaches the descent of all mankind from a single pair, and consequently that there must have been a supernatural interposition at some subsequent period which changed the human creation into its actual and existing forms of being. And if there has been, at any time, a special revelation made to man and supernatural interposition in regard to other things, then this alteration or recreation of separate species is no more irrational or improbable than other things pertaining to that revelation, and which are universally assented to by the religious world. A revelation is necessarily supernatural. That is, in direct contradiction to the normal order. But it may be said that the Creator is not the slave of his own laws, and in his immaculate wisdom and boundless power might see fit to change the order of the human creation. And certainly, the same almighty power which took the Hebrews over the Red Sea on dry land, that saved a pair of all living things in the Ark of Noah, or dispersed the builders of Babel, could, with equal ease, reform or recreate human life, and in future ordain that, instead of one, there should be several species of men. This is a matter, however, in regard to which the author does not assume to decide, to question, to venture an opinion, or even to hazard a conjecture. It is clearly and absolutely beyond the reach of human intelligence, and therefore not within the province of legitimate inquiry. The Almighty has, in his infinite wisdom and boundless beneficence, hidden from as many things, a knowledge of which would doubtless injure us. And the origin of the human races belongs to this catalogue. Men may labour to investigate it, to tear aside the veil the Creator has drawn about it, to unlock the mystery in which he has shrouded it, and after millions of years thus appropriated, come back to the starting point, the simple, palpable, unavoidable truth. They exist, but why or wherefore, whither they came, or whence they go, is beyond the range of human intelligence. We only know, and are only permitted to know, that the several species now known to exist have been exactly exactly as at present in their physical natures and intellectual capacities through all human experience, and without a supernatural interposition or recreation, must continue thus through countless ages and as long as the existing order of creation itself continues. This we know beyond doubt or possible mistake, while whether it was thus at the beginning, or changed by a supernatural interposition at some subsequent period, is now, and always must be, left to conjecture. Those who interpret the Book of Genesis, or who believe that the Book of Genesis teaches the origin of the human family from a single pair, will, of course, believe that the Creator subsequently changed them into their present forms, while those who do not thus interpret the Bible will believe, with equal confidence, perhaps, that they were created thus at the beginning. It is not, nor could it be, of the slightest benefit to us to really and truly know the truth of this matter. All that is essential to our welfare, we already know, or may know, if we promptly apply the faculties with which the Creator has so beneficently endowed us. We only need to apply these faculties to investigate the question, to study the differences existing among the general species of men, and compare their natures and capabilities with our own, to understand our true relations with them, and thus to secure our own happiness, as well as their well-being when placed in juxtaposition with them. All this is so obvious, and the remote and abstract question of origin so hypothetical and entirely non-essential, that it seems impossible that intelligent and conscientious men would ever seek to raise an issue on it, or that they would overlook the great practical duties involved in the question and engage in a visionary and unprofitable discussion about that of which they neither do nor can know anything whatsoever. Nevertheless, some few persons seem to be especially desirous to provoke an issue on this matter, not only with science, but with common sense, and a certain reverend and a rather distinguished gentleman has publicly and repeatedly declared that the doctrine of a single human race underlies the whole fabric of religious belief, and if it is rejected, Christianity will be lost to mankind. What miserable folly, if nothing worse, is this? It is a virtual declaration that we must believe, or pretend to believe, what we know to be a lie, in order to preserve what we believe to be a truth. The existence of different species of men belongs to the category of physical fact, a thing subject to the decision of the senses, and belief neither has nor can have anything to do with the matter. It is true, the reverend gentleman in question may shut his eyes and remain in utter ignorance of the fact, or rather of the laws governing the fact, and while the ignorant may believe or pretend to believe that widely different things constitute the same thing, that white and black are identical, that white parents had at some remote time and in some strange and unaccountable manner given birth to Negro offspring. But what right has he to say to those who are conscious of the fact of different species and who know, moreover, that Negroes could no more originate from white parentage than they could from dogs or cats, that they shall stultify themselves and dishonestly pretend to believe otherwise on pain of eternal reprobation, or what he doubtless considers such, the loss of Christianity to the world? It is not the desire of the writer to either reconcile the merits of science with those peculiar interpretations of the Bible, or to exhibit any contradictions with those interpretations. An undoubting believer himself in the great doctrines of Christianity, he finds no difficulty whatsoever in this respect, and would desire to simply state the facts or what he knows to be truth, and leave the reader to form his own conclusions.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.